Major Han Rule 2. I think you're saying that you did your theoretical signals work in the classroom, and then you go out for practical tests on it.
In the classroom, we did all the Morse, and we used to listen to Reuter, and that was one of the tests to see whether you could get that down. It's very high speed.
What sort of speed did you have to get up to in receiving and
I'm
sending?
Sure. Would it have been, I can't, this might be wrong, about 20 words a minute? Would it be?
It's quite a high rate.
Very fast, yes.
And how did you learn all this? Was it just by endless practice?
Yes, well, you had a blackboard first and you got the Morse code.
Yes.
And then you sort of do it. Sort of keep repeating it.
Did it. Yes.
And you had a little key.
A buzzer key.
Yes, on the table. And you practice, and, you know, until you got your wrist right that way. But of course, the law of course is really huge to come out, so you make the wrist more flexible, you know. So
not from the elbow, from the wrist.
Right from the wrist, you see. And all those are things they gave you the tricks. And it's then a matter of time and practice, really.
What sort of radio sets were you using at that time?
Well, they were number, I don't know the ones in the numbers, they were different numbers. It wasn't until we got onto the Morris on the car. I can't honestly, they might have been a number, what they called a number two set, I think, which had a transmitter and a receiver, two separate
A stacked system.
Stacked, yes. Mm. And they were fitted in the arm of car.
And you were using those in the classroom to practice?
Yes. Mm. Only there'd probably be one of them in the classroom, and you'd be told what to do and how to, if a valve went, how to change it. And that type of repair.
So you were trained on maintenance as well as repair as well as operation?
Yes. Mm. Not too far, it's just a simple valve change.
What sort of power system did they have? Were they a battery?
Batteries, yeah, from batteries in the arm car.
All right. And what sort of range could you get out of them, those sets?
At that time, with those, always, no matter what the range, you've got a lot of interference. You know,
crackling.
Crackling and that.
Was that just atmospheric interference?
At night I used to find it worse. Mm. But during the day, I suppose you'd get 15 miles, 15 miles. I wouldn't swear to that offhand.
Was that kind of set affected by the terrain? Did you have to have a clear line of sight?
You obviously, and the size of the aerial.
Yes.
And you stopped, if you couldn't get through, you'd put up more masts.
Mm.
And they used to be sort of quite half an inch diameter. And you'd have about six of those, about 5 foot each. You couldn't do them all unless you've got a line on them and sort of held them steady. But you could get three of them up to get a good range without any hassle.
Sounds rather complicated, sort of getting it set up.
Yes, if you'd have to be in a static position.
Yes.
If you're in a forward position, obviously.
Mm. So you might get it at regimental headquarters, but the forward elements would have to have.
Well, at regimental headquarters, they had a big old number three set, which was in a great big Leyland, I think.
A box body.
Yeah, a big one, huge one. It had been to Egypt and back. In fact, we took to France, it was in 1939, and that's because of France, but there was that had the power and could sort of go anywhere.
Was there a preference for any particular type of signal? I mean, did they prefer Morse to voice, for example?
We always used voice, unless we couldn't get through, and then just the two leaders used to want to speak. You see, and so it was a case of if the two people couldn't get through, then the operator would
would use the buzzer. So you were 9 months on this signals course. Did you do anything else while you were doing that, or was it just devoted purely to signals?
Well, we were on troop training with the armoured cars.
Yes.
And you would then be in the operator's
right.
seat. You could operate it enough to talk, and so you then became an operator and do all the tactical training with the troop.
So you were doing tactical training with the troop and signals training at the same time?
Yes.
And did the two fit
after,
in?
After you were efficient enough to go out.
And, right. Well, how long did that take before you were capable of being useful on a exercise?
I joined in January, and in August I was doing troop leaders operating.
So it sounds like you've had your 3 months basic and then 3 months signals, and then after that...
That's right. Yes, I must have been doing it a little while. Because in August, I was promoted to Lance Corporal.
All right.
Yeah. So that was the sort of period of time that I obviously had experienced enough to be promoted to Lance Corporal, which period was unusual. Because normally it was a 2 year break.
Yes.
In those times, so I was sort of rather.
Accelerated promotion.
Accelerated, and I had my leg pulled by all the old soldiers and that, because we'd been in the army 12 years and it was still troopers. It was a bit difficult, but.
How did you overcome that difficulty of the old soldiers coming, as it were, with you as a boy, 6 months and a lance corporal? Yes, yes.
They hadn't even shaved.
Yeah.
Well, I think mainly I think because I was a good sport, my sports, and I had probably a personality where I wasn't upset by them, but I'd be friendly with them. You know, I wasn't not too friendly, but I could cope with them.
You'd jolly them along.
Yes, you know, and I found that was the best way. You get the best out of people if you treat them as you like to be treated.
It sounds like this is a regiment which had a considerable stability. You know, if you've got soldiers who'd serve.
Oh yes.
You know,
yes.
Was there a continual turnover of personnel, or was it relatively
stable?
Well,
we used to send certain stages of recruits to the Lebanese Arms. They were assist the regiment in Egypt. So a certain number of them would be transferred to them, you know, to reinforce them. And then, of course, there was the normal wastage. There was a lot of old soldiers who were gradually leaving the army, either done their 6 years or 12 years. But most of the sergeants were, and one officers were, had done over 12 years. So
how long were you signed on for when you joined up?
6.
You'd signed on for 6 years?
That's right.
It went beyond that a bit, didn't you?
I didn't. I know when I was on the square, when I first joined, and we were paraded as a squadron, and Field Marshal Lord Burwood came to inspect us, and the commanding officer then was Colonel Dick McCreary, you see, and he marched along the line. Little bird had stopped in front of me and he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "How old are you, my boy?" 18, sir. He turned to the colonel and he said, "He doesn't look 18, does he?" And Dick McCreary said, "No, he doesn't. I am, sir. I'm 18. I'm 18. Well, then I thought they were going to say, "Well."
They'd rumbled here.
Yeah, but they knew. They knew. But, I'm going to send me off. I was a bit frightened at the time. I thought they would be.
Well, an early encounter with a senior officer is often rather frightening.
Yes.
you're doing troop training. What sort of things were the you know, were you doing in the troop? And how big was the troop?
Well,
how was
it
organised?
Three armoured cars.
So you've got three Lanchester armoured cars.
Right.
Yeah.
And there were, I think, 12 in the squadron altogether.
So a squadron was four troops of three.
Now, there are three groups of three.
Yes.
And there's one here causes.
Right. And that was also three.
That can also do something, but mainly they operated with three troops.
Three troops out and one back to coordinate.
Yeah.
Mm. And what kind of things were you doing then in your troop training?
We started off with basic troop training, you know, camouflage and, you know, cover and movement, tactical movement, things like that.
What were the principles of tactical movement that you were taught?
Well, mainly that you'd use as much cover as you could. You'd always have one car to support the one in front. You wouldn't be charging up. One would say, if it's a bridge, you'd creep up to the bridge and make sure that was secure, and while the car behind would give cover if necessary, and that's sort of normal, like infantry.
So it's fire and movement, essentially.
Movement.
What sort of cover would you be looking for a big thing like an armoured car?
Trees. And you'd also probably camouflage quite a lot of your vehicle yourself.
What would you use for that? Netting or vegetation?
Or you'd use, I used to do lots of from the trees, cut down bush or pieces of a bush and sort of try to break up the silhouette of the vehicle. And so say once you've done your troop training, then you went into regimental training against, say, another regiment.
Ah, yes. So you'd be doing what? Trying to spot each other?
That's right. Yes. One would be defending a particular thing, and you'd probably find a way around. That helps with your map reading. Because then you'd find little streams that you could drive down. And tracks which show on the map, but you hope that the enemy wouldn't...
wouldn't pick them up.
Appreciated it, you see, and you'd find that. And it'd be good when you could do that sort of thing, yeah, and get round the back of the enemy, which we used to do quite a lot by this particular way. It was a heavy little track you could see, and it's basically good map reading.
Infiltration tactics. Did you get any specific training for observation?
Not until later, because we didn't really sort of look at fighting the enemy,
no.
So you didn't get the silhouettes or anything like that. You just knew the enemy were there.
But I mean, if you were a reconnaissance, then obviously the important thing is to actually see before you're seen, isn't it?
Right,
I mean, if you were going forward and looking for signs of the presence of an enemy force, what sort of signs would you look for, surveying the ground in front of you?
Any type of movement. And if you saw movement, then you would observe that, and so you could sort of say what was there, or guess what was there near enough. You'd soon know if it was a tank or another armored car. But if you saw a slight movement, then you would sort of have the patience to sort of keep your binoculars on it, and until you were absolutely certain, or if necessary, you could get out of the armored car, move along a bit and try to observe from another point.
What sort of binoculars did you have?
Normal
field glasses.
Yeah, normal field glasses. Nothing high powered.
How much further could you see with them than you could with the naked eye on a reasonable day?
I don't say you would see more. Once you knew something was there, you could then sort of get your binoculars out and it would blow it up enough for you to say, oh, that's so and so. Whereas with the naked eye, you probably wouldn't be too sure.
So it's a matter of getting a higher definition.
But it's. Most of the things you used to see and you could observe straight away. Because it wasn't along the desert that you really needed it for the distance. In England or wherever you did your training, you were close enough to really observe without a lot of usual binoculars.
Where were you doing most of this? Was it on the plane?
On the top, yeah.
When you were doing troop training, did you ever do opposed exercises at that level with one troop manoeuvring against another?
Not to a great extent. It was mainly the squadron operating in together against another squadron, and then we went on to
regiment v regiment,
and then went on to the big one, which was divisional. You see, where you'd come up against infantry as well,
and artillery too, presumably.
And artillery, yes.
Now, you mentioned you were doing this troop training and you were operating the radio in the armoured car. Did you actually do other things within the armoured car as well? Did they teach you to drive?
Oh, yes. You could drive and you could shoot the guns.
How did you get on with the driving of the Lanchester?
I enjoyed it. Mm. It was a big, heavy vehicle, about a dozen different gears, different low gear cycles, but it was good to drive. And you had to pass your test on that, but not as a D&M others who were D&M who could maintain it, repair it, and that sort of thing. All I did was the basic drive it, so if anything happened within the troop,
you could take over.
The same with the guns.
How long did it take you to learn to drive? What was the length of the course of that?
Well, you did it within the troop.
Yeah, I see.
You see, and so there wasn't a particular time that you'd be out, and the troop leader would say, you know, you get in, and you'd then, once you knew the basics, then you'd have the division driver sitting behind you, and that's what the troop leader up top. And eventually he would be the one who would pass you down.
What were the controls? Did you have a steering wheel?
Yes,
on the so it's like an ordinary civilian car.
Much heavier.
Much heavier. You didn't have power steering then?
Not
on the Lanchester.
No.
But I mean, I'm talking about the general character of the controls.
Everything was big.
Yeah.
And the gears, there were two sets of gears down here, sort of one fast, about four or five gears, and the other low box.
Yeah.
Then you crawled up a hill, these things as well, the hill sort of.
Edging up. What sort of speed could you get out of the Lanchester going?
I should say, because everything is different then, because if it's a big vehicle, noisy. When you're going, say, 20 mile an hour, you seem to be doing 60.
Yeah.
Especially compared with a modern car. So I should say if you got 30 out of them, that would be about it, I should think.
What about cross-country speed? What would you normally...
Because they're solid.
Yeah, the suspension.
So you have to be very careful.
Yes.
They don't do it for... speed across country, unless it's sort of social game where you've got a good stretch.
Yeah.
But they weren't sort of strong very well at all.
Was there a sort of speed you aimed for when you were manoeuvring, you know, sort of tactical speed for moving across country?
No set speed, it was just according to how you could get down.
So circumstances.
And
how many of you would there be in Lanchester?
Four.
So what would the...
That'd be the commander, the gunner, the operator, and the driver.
What was it like being inside one of these things?
Well, very closed community, you know, because the driver only had a little visa to look through.
Yes.
And he had to rely on his side mirrors to, you know, if he had to come back or anything.
Yeah.
And the gunner, the operator, sat on the floor. And we had a sole boat type cushion and just sat on the floor.
Below the turret?
Yeah. And behind the driver.
Yeah.
And
Was it possible to be comfortable inside a Lanchester?
I think the only person who could be comfortable perhaps could be the driver, who could lean back in his seat, but everyone else had to lean against it. Box of ammunition or something, and the commander would be standing up, as would be the gunner. And a bit, but there was a small seat that you could sit on, and that'd be, and raise one up to look out of the tower. But mainly you stood.
What about the noise and the heat and so on?
It's quite warm inside, and of course, when the engine was running and we were climbing, that was surprising. And the other thing he had in the floor, you can look like a little cat and drop a chain onto the floor, and the driver could press a switch and it would electrically the outside of the
Electrify the outside of the tower.
Right. So
course.
If anybody was climbing on it, you could just not enough to kill anyone, but enough to sort of
give them a shock.
That's right. And you had this sort of thing. I've never come across that in any other
That does sound very unusual. An electrified armoured car.
That's right,
what
came off the back of the hour, right?
Yes.
Enough to keep people away.
What this was a four wheeled vehicle.
No.
Six wheels?
Two driving wheels.
Yes.
Double set at the back.
Right.
Okay.
And you said the suspension was fairly solid and hard.
Yeah. It had the turret, and then there was a space at the back of the vehicle, about that length,
about 3 foot.
With a seat either side where you could carry people. On the back.
You could have passengers then?
You could do. Well, probably might have been there for infantry or whatever. You know, and so the food could sit there and feed that. And that was the well, and then the rest of the armoured car would be doing something.
And were they basically a reliable vehicle, mechanically?
Oh, yes, they were good engine, Manchester was a good engine.
What was it powered by, diesel or petrol?
I don't think we ever had armoured cars powered by diesel.
I mean, one of the great risks of being an armoured vehicle is it catching fire. Did you have escape drills to get out of it quickly?
No, I don't think so. Not that I can recall. I mean, the operator had these doors at the side.
Yes.
The driver could also get back and get out. And the two at the top, behind the turret.
Through the hatch.
We had fire extinguishers in the vehicle, so that would be good. Yeah. But they could touch fluoride.
Powder. Powder.
No.
Yeah. Foam?
And the little glass things, you know the ones I mean?
Yes.
We didn't have foam on the
So it was a powder?
No, just a liquid.
A liquid?
Carbon tetra fluoride.
Now you mentioned also using the weapons and that the armament was 0.5 and a 303.
Yes.
Did you have a range you could go and shoot on?
Yes. Every year you went on the ranges, the regiment went on the ranges, and each gunner did his tests on the guns.
And was that where you were taught to shoot with them?
Yes, yes. But you're only given nowhere near the amount of time as the actual gunner.
What sort of ranges would you shoot at with the 0.5?
Oh, 700 yards, 800 yards perhaps. You know, for accuracy. I think they might have gone up to 1,000, but I don't think there would be much fun because they wouldn't have pierced anything at 1,000 yards.
Were they intended to be an armour piercing?
The 0.5.
0.5. What sort of arm would it go through?
None. It really, it might go through 1/4 inch, if that. But they're no good against tanks.
And what sort of arm did you have on the Lanchester? Was that a...
That'd be about 1/4 inch.
1/4 inch.
Turret would be a little bit, but not. But we never went forward with the Lanchester.
No, that's right. And what kind of targets were you shooting at then on the ranges?
With canvas type cars.
Oh, right. So it'd be the standard bullseye target, a round shape on square.
Yes.
Well, I mean, when you were being taught to shoot, were you taught to shoot in short bursts or single shots or?
Well, you were taught to conserve your ammunition and use what you considered to be worthy of.
And what was the 303 for? Was that for dealing with infantry?
Infantry, yes.
Was that a Bren gun or some other sort of...
That was a Vickers.
That was a Vickers 303, yes.
Vickers.
Water-cooled?
Yes. But we didn't have them... to take them to? I'm trying to think when we got rid of them. When we went to Aldershot, probably about 1938, probably.
Yes. You were saying you went to Aldershot. Was that a permanent transfer?
Yes,
or
when we finished at Tidworth.
Yes.
We went to Aldershot for the barracks there, four birth barracks. And then we were issued with the Norris on the car.
What was the, how was the change from Aldershot, from Tidworth to Aldershot received? Was it a...
Well, I think everybody enjoyed it because Tidworth was a little bit isolated, I think.
Mm. Out in the sticks.
That's right, yeah. And Aldershot was a little bit nearer a town, you know, or people were barracks inside the town.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Barracks was the town.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Mm.
So you moved to Aldershot, and while you were at Aldershot, you were saying that you got the Lanchester replaced by the Morris, but in the meantime you said that you'd done regimental manoeuvres, and then you'd done divisional manoeuvres. Which division was that? Do you remember
the cavalry division in Tidworth.
Yes.
There were lots of cavalry regiments there at the time, the 9 months and the 10 hours for that. And so it was a cavalry, either brigade or division that you were. And you had the Highland Regiment with that. It was quite, you know, well, it was one big.
Was this in the autumn? Was this an autumn manoeuvre?
Yeah, towards the end, once we built up troop training, regimental training, and then you ended up with a divisional.
Do you remember much about what was going on then? Did you have any clear picture of what was happening at?
Not really. They didn't tell. The troop officers knew, but it wasn't sort of class plan. All you did was your job. And I know in one particular case, we thought we'd done that. We charged down a particular road. There was loads of lorries and infantry, all the enemy, and we went right through, firing our guns. Which were blank then at the time, straight through the line. We thought we'd done jolly well, but they ruled out and we wouldn't have got away with it if that had been the real thing.
Did they say that? Spoil sport.
Yeah.
This is the umpires, was it?
Yeah, we thought we'd done very well. I mean, if you could go down and you, as we thought, caught them unawares.
And then, well, they lined up in column of route?
Yeah. Well, out, sort of up there. Doing different things. You know,
oh, I see. And they weren't even moving. They'd stopped. They'd halted on the march.
We charged right down this long column and just flying
Do you know who they were in that column for? Didn't stop to ask.
No.
Did they have any anti-tank guns in that?
Didn't see any. No. I think, you know, I know what they'd been that thing to have done. Been wonderful. I did it once, similar to that, on the desert with Matt Abraham. I'll tell you about that later. That's a similar sort of thing, and we got away with it. I think we could have got away with it.
Perhaps they were being overcautious, so you weren't overconfident.
That's right.
did you have any training or lectures upon how to deal with anti-tank weapons or with enemy armour?
No. The troop leaders may have done, but certainly we didn't.
Not as crewmen in the armoured cars. Did you usually serve in the same armoured car, or were they? You weren't mixed around in the troop.
The same troop.
Yes.
And so you knew your driver, you knew your troop leader, and you knew the gunner.
What you were saying earlier on, it sounds as though when you were doing basic training, it was primarily NCOs who were dealing with you.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously once you were doing troop training, you'd have started having more dealings with officers.
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
No. It's the NCOs who should do all the training, really. The troop leaders there in those days, obviously they came and did that degree, but most of their time was to spend riding and that kind of thing, hunting. A good life for an officer in those days.
How did you get on with the officers when you did meet them?
Well, they were very good. They were gentlemen, and you didn't have a lot of contact with them, but when you did, they were nice to you. You know, I couldn't say there was any officer that I disliked or people said they disliked.
Well, was the relationship a very formal one?
Very formal.
With regard to saluting and other signs of discipline?
You had to saluting every time you saw them. But they were two gentlemen.